Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to the Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to the Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, thank you for joining me and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and if you are new here, this is where we take a deep dive into the entertainment industry to provide you with valuable insights and entertaining stories. This week, we get to talk with a producer, an engineer, and an artist development strategist. However, this week it's going to be a little different, because tonight's guest, well, it's going to be me. We'll discuss my studios, both past and present, the difference between working in New York and Nashville, and we'll take a deep dive into artist development. Now, as I said, this one's going to be a little different. We recently had Rena Friedman Watts on the show. It was back on episode 35, and she offered to come back and turn the tables on me. So, well, here we are. She is an amazing host, and it wouldn't surprise me if it got a little personal. So if you would like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started.
Jay, how are you, sir?
I am fantastic. How are you?
Yes, I am fantastic too. Put the kids to bed for this. I want to know how you get away with doing this in the evenings. You are a dad of three. Where are your kiddos?
Three. They are in bed. 13 and 9 go to bed at 9:30. I guess the newborn goes to bed around there as well. I say newborn, toddler, year and a half.
She is adorable. And last time we connected and I had you on my show, she wasn't born yet.
No, we go way back.
Now, you have done a lot of podcasts and you've authored books. Which do you think you would rather start from the beginning on now? Do you think you'd rather write another book or start another podcast?
I like podcasting, hands down. I laugh about it all the time. I've never read a book. I listen to books, but I don't read. I have a hard time reading. I read very slow in order to capture anything. But my wife used to make fun of me because I've written books, but I don't read them. And she reads like nobody's business. So they bust my cookies about that. But no, I'd much rather do podcasts. It's more in my wheelhouse, the audio and the controls and the editing and all those things I just find fun. And then talking to people is always fun too.
Yeah, talk about your wheelhouse and a little bit about kind of the journey that you've taken in your career.
Oh, well, I mean, the very first thing for me, I mean, I remember playing in bands as a kid in high school. I played in this one band called Low Profile, where we would play the local bars, then we would open up for bigger acts. And I remember staying and watching some of the bigger acts and realizing, yeah, I'm not ever going to be able to do that. Especially this one band called The Fools. They were a very large regional band. They used to sing the song Doo-Wah Diddy. And that singer got on and put on such a show. I mean, it was so wild. And by the end of the show, he was naked from head to toe, naked, standing on the stage singing. And between the show and the songs and the musicianship, I was like, dear God, I'm never going to be able to do this. And I really enjoyed writing songs. And, you know, I didn't want to play in cover bands. I wanted to play in original bands, write the songs. I wanted to go in the studio and record them. Because I thought recording songs is much more fun. You get to record them and you can play them over and over and over again. It wasn't like when you play a show and it's over later that night. I put something on a recording and I could listen to it forever and play it for people. And I was much happier doing that. And so I did that for years, and I decided I wanted to go to school for it. And I told my parents at the time, and they thought I was crazy, but they supported me. You know, they were okay with it. I told my dad, I said, hey, look, I want to go to audio school. And he's like, okay. And at this time, I was already 2 years deep into architectural engineering. So I said, I want to switch over to audio engineering. And I found this school. At the time, there was only one school in the country that was teaching it, and it was a place in Ohio. So he said, all right. And I kid you not, it was maybe 3 to 5 days later, I was in the school and it was on my birthday. It was 1989, January 9th. I went there and I learned the craft of engineering, and that's where I felt like, okay, this is my thing. I may not be able to get on stage and perform like everybody else, but I can sit down here and I can press the buttons and, you know, I can compete with the best of them doing this.
And you don't have to take your clothes off.
Well, I don't have to, but I still do from time to time.
Have you really?
Just being lucky that this isn't Tuesday, because Topless Tuesdays, those shows are wild.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. And your dad was an engineer.
My dad was a civil engineer, yeah. My family's from New York, and I grew up in Boston because he went to Northeastern, which is in Boston, and then stayed. And he ended up opening a contracting company, and he built like some of the biggest high-rises in Boston, and he did some really impressive stuff in the construction world, won a lot of awards for the storefronts that he built on Newbury Street, which is Boston's version of Rodeo Drive. So, I mean, it was good. I worked for him for years. I mean, I got abused working for him for years, but I worked for him for years. I say I got abused because I would be tiny at the time running a jackhammer, and I just remember bouncing all over the streets of Boston. It was funny. It was a good time, but it was hard work, definitely hard work.
Did you take some of those skills in building the studios that you've built?
I would say, yeah. I mean, at least the knowledge of it, because I didn't actually do the work myself, but I was able to tell them what I wanted. I was able to supervise it, and don't get me wrong, the guy who did it did a great job, and he did not need my guidance, but at least understanding it and being able to communicate what I wanted and what I needed, I think that made a difference. The studio I used to own in New York, it was built from the ground up, and that one I had a lot of involvement. I worked with a contracting company. I designed the room from what I learned in architectural engineering and what I knew from audio school. So I designed the room to at least the best of what I could do. And it was the best of what I could do. But come to find out years later, it could have been better. This room I'm sitting in right now is just the control room. But this control room is leaps and bounds better than the one I had in New York.
Tell me how you made use of the studio in New York.
No, that was fun. I recorded all the local rock bands. They were independent rock bands. There was nobody famous that came through or anything like that, but they were bands that were playing regional shows and opening up for famous acts. It was a good time because I get to work on a project from start to finish, which doesn't typically happen. It's different teams that do different sections of the project, whether that be the initial tracking or the editing or the mixing or the mastering. I mean, those are all engineering jobs, but they're usually done by a different person. The artwork is done by a different person. The photography is done by a different person. But up in New York, I was able to do all that stuff myself, or at least have my team do it if I wasn't the actual person doing it. And that, to me, is really what got me into more of the development side than just being an engineer.
And how was New York different than Tennessee?
Ooh, big difference. New York was one of those places where you're dealing with independent artists who typically don't have studio experience. So you have to walk them through the entire process, how to book the sessions, what's truly needed, what's not needed. All this before you even get into the artistic piece of it. You got to go through all of the administrative side with people. Where in Nashville, it's a business. I mean, when it says music business, the emphasis is on business. I mean, there's a union. The musicians are hired on three-hour blocks. The studios are rented out by the day. There's a reason why country music, whether you like it or not, there's a reason why it is so technically good.
Didn't you do a little bit of work in gospel, too?
A little bit. In Nashville, there's a good gospel scene as well as country music. And now there's even a rock scene, too. I mean, there's a lot of rock bands moving there. One of my favorite bands is a band called Hailstorm. And Hailstorm has relocated to Nashville. They're from Pennsylvania, but they've relocated to Nashville, and they've done some work with Jay Joyce, who's a great producer in Nashville. I mean, fantastic producer. And he has his own studio there as well, and he does things in more of an unconventional manner when it comes to how Nashville typically works. So he does more of the New York vibe, you know, go in a little later in the day, you know, take your time. It's his studio, so we're not paying by the hour. You're not hiring musicians because you have a self-contained band. You know, it was more of a vibe than it is a system. You know, when you're working with studio musicians and you're dealing with the union and you're renting the studios, you're renting everything in blocks. Not only is everything already pre-planned before you ever set foot into a studio, but it moves very fast and you have to be able to keep up with it, because if you're not keeping up with it, you're spending somebody else's money.
Tell me a time that you spent somebody else's money and you felt super under the gun.
Yeah, definitely felt under the gun. I spent a lot of time working for a guy named Bob Bullock, one of the best producers in the world, headquartered in Nashville. He's from California. I mean, he's done everything from Shania Twain to George Strait and so on. He's worked with everybody. But anyways, I was working on a project for him, and I remember I set up the entire studio for him, and he came in and they were recording, and one of the musicians, their headphones went out, and he says, "Go." And I ran out in the room and I got him another set of headphones and set it up and got it going, and they started playing again, and then the headphones went out again. So it was either the headphone box we were plugging it into or it was the headphones themselves, but either way, I didn't have any more. There was no more boxes. There were no more headphones. And he said, "Well, go give him yours." And it was like, go, 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 because we're spending other people's money. And at the end of the day, time is money here. And, you know, we're going to do whatever it takes to capture the moment when they're ready to provide us with the moment. And we're going to do it without anything slowing down on our behalf. So, yeah, that was a lesson learned. Definitely a lesson learned, and learned quickly.
So do you now always have extra headphones or any other extra components laying around?
I do. I have extra everything. Anything that I can have that's extra. I mean, sometimes you don't have a choice. You know, you go into a studio and they have maybe 10 sets of headphones and you got 10 musicians in a room, you're kind of strapped. But most of the time you don't have 10 people playing at one time. You might have 5 to 8 people playing at one time. And you just try to keep a couple extra headphones. You might keep a couple extra microphones ready to go in case something goes wrong. I mean, those things happen.
Did you ever just like make a joke about it?
I make jokes about everything. So, but yeah, you got to realize the time and place for everything, right? So when you're under the gun and you're spending somebody else's money, it's not something you want to joke about. But if it's just a quick go fix something or go take care of something, yeah, you make a joke of it because you want to keep people comfortable, because if they're not comfortable, they're not going to perform well. And if they're not performing well, then you're wasting money in that manner. So you really want to make sure that you're on top of things, but you want to make sure that you can keep things light.
Have things ever been like so laid back and cool that they've taken you out with the band?
Tons of times. Absolutely. I mean, especially back in the New York days, I would go out with those bands all the time. But then there's been times I was at a record label party in Nashville. They would have it at Sony Records every Monday evening. And every Monday evening, they'd go in and find out where they placed on the charts for the week, and that they can start promoting their artists. And I would go there, and there'd be a few artists that I would see every week. And they would always ask me, you know, after that, "Well, let's go hang out at the," we went to Denny's a lot. "So let's go hang out at Denny's." And so we'd leave the party, because the parties were like at 5 or 6 o'clock, right after the work day. They would be at the VP's office. So then we'd go over to Denny's and grab something to eat and, you know, take off from there. Billy Ray Cyrus was one of the nicest people, and we used to go to Denny's all the time.
What did you order?
No idea.
The French slam?
I couldn't tell you what I ate for breakfast today. My memory's horrible when it comes to certain things.
Has your wife gotten any backstage passes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just recently, where'd we go? We went to the Oak Ridge Boys. Scotty Simpson, bass player, he plays bass for the Oak Ridge Boys. He came to town and he got us passes to go see the Oak Ridge Boys and go hang out with him, which was cool because I thought it was cool. I'd take my wife, we go there, and we go backstage, and we get to meet everybody. We go on the tour bus, we're hanging out, we're having a good time. Yeah, I mean, she had fun, but I don't think she thinks of it as special as some other people might have thought of it. But she had a good time. She took a couple pictures of us hanging out backstage and stuff. But this summer, I had a few opportunities to go to some really good shows.
Which ones?
Steve Miller Band. Chris Franz was on the show, and he gave me a couple passes to see Steve Miller because he was working on the show. Went to Brooks and Dunn. Jeff King and John Root both worked for Brooks and Dunn, and they were both on the show. Jeff King is one of the best musicians I've ever seen. He's a guitar player out of Nashville. And I was talking to him about keeping things light. He has a really good way. I mean, the guy is he's a big man. He's tall. He just comes across as a force. But he's as friendly as can be and as nice as can be. And he is constantly joking in the studio, constantly keeping things light, making sure everybody's comfortable. A great guy. He's in the studio almost every day, but on weekends he goes and tours with typically Reba, and he was out with Brooks and Dunn as well. So we got to see Brooks and Dunn when they came to town.
That's awesome. Do you and your wife have the same taste in music?
I laugh because when I met my wife, she told me that Staind was her favorite band. And Staind is a rock band from Boston. So I'm like, okay, this is going to work. This is going to be great because, you know, I love country music, but rock music has always been my favorite. Well, yeah, she might like it, but that's probably the only rock band she knows of. So I feel like I got duped. I mean, I think we like the same stuff for the most part. But if we're driving in the car separately, there's probably different radio stations on.
Love it. Does she like the Red Sox?
I don't think she cares about baseball, but if we go to games, she'll put the Red Sox hat on.
She's a sport.
She is a sport. Now, she didn't want to put the Red Sox hat on when we went to a Cincinnati game because Red Sox came to Cincinnati and she didn't want to do it then. She's like, we're going to get our butt kicked. I'm like, don't worry about that. We went to the game and there was more Red Sox hats than there were Reds hats. She's a sport.
That's cute.
She's a sport for putting up with my crap.
For putting up with your crap? Talk to me about becoming a dad at 53.
Oh, that's brutal. Three kids now, 13, 9, and 1. And 13 was like, okay. My wife said she wanted one kid. At the time, I didn't want any. So, you know, I'm like, all right, we'll do one. And she's like, well, I don't even know if I could get pregnant. And we tried and she got pregnant. So I'm like, okay, great. And we have a kid. And then she's like, well, I want another one. All right, well, we tried again. Took a while, but we got another one. And then she's like, I want another one. I told her now, it's like, forget it. You don't have to go back to work. Just stop having kids. You know, we're fine. Because now we get the three kids. And I mean, I love them all. I do. Well, yeah, no, okay, I love them all. But they're a handful. They are a handful. They've got me running like crazy. I shouldn't be running this hard at 50-something years old. It's crazy.
Doesn't it keep you young?
Sure. It's going to keep me younger and going to run me into the grave, one of the two. I like to think of it as keeping me young.
Aww.
Like, I'll brag about my kids for a minute. My 13-year-old is a cheerleader, and she's going to state. And the 9-year-old auditioned and got into the Nutcracker for the actual Cincinnati Ballet, which is very cool. But because of those two things, literally one does cheer every day of the week, one does dance every day of the week. So there's very little free time. And that's why we're here at 10 o'clock at night.
I was going to say, who does all of those drives?
We pretty much split it up. My wife does a lot of the dance stuff. I do a lot of the cheerleading stuff. I like to do the driving, so I'll do as much of it as possible. And I would rather do that than stay home with the baby anyway.
And speaking of driving, you even with your daughter were like doing Amazon together so that she could make money and you guys could have some special moment time together, right?
Yes, and we haven't done it in a long time, but we did it this past weekend. And it was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. But yes, when I was a kid, I had a paper route. You know, it started with my dad driving me around the neighborhood, and I would throw papers out the window. So I thought about that, and I told my kids, because she keeps asking for a job because she wants to have her own money. So I said, fine. I said, I'll tell you what. We'll go ahead and get an Amazon account, and we'll deliver packages, and, you know, I'll drive you around, but you're doing all the work. So that's what we do. And we did it this weekend, and it was a rough day. We got one of the hardest runs you can get. We had to go to every city location where you can't park, and you have to, you know, have a code to get in a building. All these special instructions to get to a place. It wasn't like just going to somebody's house and dropping off a package. It was work. So she was tired when she got home.
Did you do some of the drop-offs, or was she doing them all?
I won't do any unless it's a sketchy area. If it's something sketchy, I won't let her do it. But as long as this stuff is reasonable, no, that's her gig, not mine.
Did you go to the Taylor Swift movie with her?
I did not. My wife did, though. My wife took him. I would have gone. I would have done it. But no, that was my wife's thing. She wanted to do that for them. She got them the tickets. We would have gone to the concert, but we couldn't even get tickets. I mean, couldn't find them anywhere.
Yeah. Was your daughter giving you a hard time? Like, you know all these musicians and you can't get me tickets?
No. Luckily, no. Luckily, no. I know a lot of people who've played on her record. We had a couple of the musicians on the show that have played on her records. So I do know a few of them, but it's not like I can call them up and say, hey, do me a favor and call Taylor for me. No, that's a show that I'm not gonna have any connections to. Even if I would be willing to.
Is that a no-no?
Yeah, I would never call somebody asking for tickets. I mean, if they want to give them to me, I'll gladly take them. I mean, the ones I went to this summer, people said, hey, I'm coming through town. And a couple of the shows, I even bought the tickets myself, but then they would give me the backstage passes when I got there. I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't mind. If you want to give them to me, I'll take them. I mean, I took my 9-year-old. We went to the Brooks and Dunn show, and she got to go backstage. She got to go up on the stage. She got to sit at the drum kit and beat on the drums for a little while. She got to go stand center stage, look out on the arena and everything. So she had the time of her life.
Is it important to you to plant the seeds of loving music in your children?
I think they do it on their own. I mean, my 13-year-old, she plays in the school band. She plays saxophone, and she owns 2 guitars now that she's waiting to start taking lessons on. But she has her own style of music that she likes. And part of it is Taylor Swift. I mean, she's a big Taylor Swift fan, a Swiftie, as the kids call it. But she likes the Arctic Monkeys. You know, I took her to see the Arctic Monkeys down in Nashville. We went down there, and I drove her and a friend of hers to see the show, and we spent the night in Nashville. It was cool. It was fun. But she's got a love for her own style of music and things she likes. And then the 9-year-old has a love for her own style of music, and it probably stems from dance. However, she does like Olivia Rodrigo is her big thing right now.
That's cute. Did your parents, like, have expectations for you? Or did they kind of let you be who you wanted to be?
They let me do whatever I wanted, but I'll tell you, their expectations probably did not include the music industry, I'll tell you that. My father, if he wasn't happy with the decision to go to switch to audio engineering from architectural engineering, he never really said anything. He did advise me to have a backup plan, and I did. I went to business school, and I got a business degree. But I chose a backup plan that would apply to the music industry because I can use a business degree in any industry. It didn't have to be in construction or something like that. So I tried to choose wisely. But my mother, no matter what kind of success I ever had, whether I was the head instructor at the engineering college or whether I was recording bands that she would hear on the radio, no matter what it was always, when are you going to get a real job? To her, an entry-level accounting position would be better than recording records that were on the radio. So, because she just didn't know. In Boston, people weren't doing that. That was not a common thing. In Nashville, everybody works in the music business somehow.
Do you think that she became proud of you for some of the music work that you've done?
I'd like to think so. I mean, we never sat down and had that conversation, but I've played some songs that I've written for her, and she's liked them, and she's played them for other people. My father passed away, and I wrote a song for my father, and, you know, I think that made her cry. And when I went away to college, I wrote a song for my mother, and I think she liked that.
Aw, that's sweet.
Yeah, See, I'm a good guy.
What about for your wife?
Oh, that girl. I did. I wrote a song for her. It was cut by an artist in Nashville. So, I mean, it's one of my more successful songs. I was very happy with the song. It's probably one of my favorite that I've ever written. It's one of my favorite that I've written, engineered, and produced, hands down.
Yeah, I definitely want to check that out. I feel like, is it true that guys want to be rock stars to get chicks?
Absolutely. Hands down. There's no other reason to do it. That's the entry level 101 reason everybody starts to play music.
That's so funny. Out of like all the musicians that you've now interviewed, how many have said that?
I don't know. It's never a question that comes up. But I used to write songs and try to impress girls all the time. Nobody was ever impressed. But you do it thinking you're going to impress somebody.
Oh my God, that's awesome. Did you ever like give one to a girl?
Yeah, well, I gave one to my wife. So yeah.
That's sweet.
It is what it is. I used to write a lot of sappy love songs, a lot of them. I loved rock music, and Journey was my favorite band, that style of music. And the songs I wrote were in that vein. You know, they sounded like Journey-esque or Air Supply-esque.
Did you like put on performances for your friends or family growing up?
Not individually, no. I played in bands that have, absolutely. That wasn't my thing. But I did it for a number of years. I played in bar bands, and we did that type of stuff.
One of the songs you wrote, didn't it end up on Saturday Night Live?
Yep. Once I kind of got better at the craft and started to realize that there was something more to it than trying to please a girl, I ended up getting published by a company out of New York. And that company, they put songs in TV shows and movies. That was their thing. So in Nashville, the publishing companies typically try to sell your stuff to an artist so they can record it and release it. And this company took your song as is, so it had to be 100% produced and ready to go, which was what I liked doing. So I would write songs, and I would go in the studio, and I would produce my own songs. And then if they were good enough and they fit what they needed, they would publish them. And they published, you know, probably 100 or so of my songs. And then what they do is they put them on, or they used to put them on catalog discs. So every time they see a song that would fit a certain category, they'd put it on their disc and they'd have like 10 songs total. And if a TV show or movie would say, hey, we need a song that's like this, and they would send them a catalog disc that's like whatever style that they were looking for. And for Saturday Night Live, they were looking for a pop piano type song. So it was in a skit with John and Paul from the Beatles, and they were sitting at a piano, and it came across as if they were writing a song together. But in reality, they were planning on opening a fried chicken joint, was the joke of the whole thing. So the whole time they're, you know, playing this piano piece and they're talking about it, and it sounds like they're writing a song. But it turns out, no, they were doing this fried chicken joint thing. And it was cool. That was probably my most successful song from a monetization point. I mean, that song paid well for quite a while because it would rerun in a ton of different countries. So that song, it paid fairly well for a while.
Now, when I introduced you earlier, we talked a little bit about artist development as something that you do. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, can you help people create a song, license it?
Yeah. In Nashville, there's a lot of people who do production stuff. But what that basically means is, say you're a singer. You could find someone like myself who would take you and help you either select songs or help you write the songs you may already have, and then take you into the studio. And somebody like myself would hire the musicians, they would rent the studio, they would know all of the things that would need to be done in order to produce a project. So you have that type of production. So it's basically somebody who's going to hold your hand and guide you through the whole process to make sure that you're making efficient use of your time and your money, and you're getting the product that you intend to get. So I think that's very important to understand those things from a business point of view before you get into the artistic point of view. Because the person who's coming to you, they have to have a vision of what they're expecting. And then you have to decide whether or not you can meet that vision. And if you can, you set out a roadmap, and a good producer, a good person who's developing this artist, would lay that road plan out so that they understand it and they can see it and they don't feel like they're getting ripped off in any way. You want to explain to them every step of the way where every dollar is going. What I would do when I worked with artists is I would not take the money. So I would always say, okay, this is the studio. This is how much they charge for the day. And they would write the check directly to the studio. That way they knew where the money was going, and they learned the process and they learned how things would happen. And I think it's that type of communication that really helps an artist feel comfortable. But then there's other types of development. Like when I was in New York, I worked with a band called Hazen Jane, which was a rock band out of upstate New York. Very, very good, very talented group of young guys. But I had to walk them through everything, and I did it all in my studio. Everything from helping them write or polish up their songs. They wrote the songs, but I helped them polish them up. And then establish what we wanted to do, what the game plan was. How many songs are we going to put together? What kind of project is it going to be? Then we get through the whole recording process. And I had them sit with me when I mixed their songs and did everything and got them ready for manufacturing. And then I helped them do their photography for their album covers. I helped them do the artwork and get that taken care of. I did all the artwork and all that stuff for them. They had their own logo design, but I took the logo and did the artwork and the photography. We went on the bridges of New York, and we were taking pictures on the bridges, probably places we shouldn't have been, just doing all the things we probably shouldn't be doing. But it was great. And the album cover's on the website if anybody ever wants to go look at it. But we did this stuff, and it was fun, and we got to do everything, right down to when it was over. Here's your finished product in your hand. Now let's talk about how we can get this in the hands of a radio station or booking agents to get you some bigger shows and things like that. I like that type of development more than I like just walking somebody through start to finish of a recording process. That's great, and that's fun, and usually you're working with the best of the best in the world to do that. But to walk somebody through the entire process, and you know, you're engineering one day and working with photographers or graphic artists the next day, it's an entire package. A lot of the stuff I do these days is just advice. So it just really depends on the goal. And what I like to do is establish what their goal is and then work backwards. Just deconstruct it and figure out the best way of doing it. And then sharing those ideas with people and strategizing and saying, yes, you could do it this way, but it's probably more beneficial if you were to do it this way. And I like to lay out three different ways and let them make a decision. You know, which way you choose to go should be up to you.
Have you gotten on the radio?
Yeah, a handful of times. And I've obviously worked for big artists that are on the radio all the time. But when I work on the big projects, I'm one of many. You know, usually working for somebody like Bob Bullock, great producer, major bands when working for Bob. And yes, all those records end up on the radio. But like I said, I'm one of many, and he's the one calling the shots, not me. I'm just the one setting up microphones and running signal through a console and pressing record on the Pro Tools system in most cases. So yeah, I mean, I'm part of that, and I'm as happy as can be to be part of that. But that's not my doing to get those songs on the radio. There's a team of hundreds of people, and there's so many people involved in those type of projects. But when I'm doing independent artists like that band out of New York, or I worked with a young lady out of Nashville, and the one I worked out of Nashville, 10 songs on her record. I wrote 9 of them. She wrote 1. The one that she wrote went to number 1 on the radio. Not the ones I wrote, the one that she wrote. And she had no writing experience. She just came to me with one song. She said, I just have this idea. I said, great, let's put it on. And we produced it and we did it, and you know, it was great. So you never know. You have no idea what's going to happen, what songs are going to take off, which ones aren't, just what people prefer.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you make it in Nashville?
Well, it's the joke. How do you make $1 million in Nashville? You start off with 2. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people sink a lot of money and invest in artists and people and studios, and a lot of it doesn't work out.
Okay, that's a great transition into your podcast because you put a lot of time and effort and artistry and passion into it. And thank you so much for letting me host it.
I can't believe you agreed to it.
What keeps you going?
Oh.
Because it is so much work, even if you love it.
I do love it. I absolutely do love it. It's probably one of my favorite projects I've ever worked on. And it's much, much more than just the conversations I get to have and the people I get to talk to, and which is great. I get to talk to people like yourself. I get to hear your stories. It's one of my favorite episodes, not only because of your stories, but because I like your sense of humor. I get to talk to all my friends from the music industry. I get to talk to people I've never met before that work in TV and movies and people from the radio and authors. And so besides all of that stuff, which to me is baseline, that should be fun, talking to all the people. The stuff that most people don't like about putting shows together, I also like that stuff. I love editing. I love putting shows together. I love being, I'm a very creative editor, which is probably not a good thing in a lot of cases, but musically as well as shows, I like to be creative with edits. I don't just like to slap on an intro and an outro and call it done. You know, aside from the technical stuff of making sure levels are good and they meet the standards of Apple and others, which kills me because Apple's standards and Spotify's standards are different. But that's technical. I like to be creative as well. So I don't just do the technical stuff or just the cleanup stuff. I like to make sure that things tell a story, that the things are as tight as they can be without being sterile. But I want things to flow. I want them to sound as good as possible. If there's something I can do to make something sound better, I want to make it sound better. It comes from the days of mixing records. If I can notice something that could be better, it should be better. But same thing with the show. Each week, I try to do something more, something better. I enjoy doing those things. It's not enough time in the day to do it all, but yeah, I absolutely enjoy doing it.
I love that. Yeah, I was interested in how the music industry has changed from the start of your career until now.
Yeah, that's a big change. In the start of my career, bands didn't have the money or the tools to do things on their own. So they would have to play gigs and save up money or get an investor so they could go in the studio and record their songs. And they would. And they would do that, and they'd usually put out an EP, which stood for extended play, versus an LP, which stood for long play. And basically what that would mean is they'd get 5 songs instead of 10. And they'd release a 5-song EP to try to make their money. Nowadays, it's not like that at all. Nowadays, people can agonize and stress, just like I'm talking about for myself. People do that at home. You know, they can record the same vocal 5,000 times until they get the one that they want. It's best if you have a vocal coach when you're doing things like that. I would never recommend a singer to just do that at home on their own. I would always bring in a vocal coach whenever recording a singer. For one, it goes quicker, so you save money in the studio. But for two, you're guaranteeing that you're going to get the best performance out of that person. That's not my strong point. So I am not comfortable coaching a singer to that level. You know, if we're doing a demo in this studio or something like that, that's fine. But if we're doing a record that's going to be played on the radio that, you know, millions of people will hear, let's bring in a professional that does nothing but vocals. And then we'll go ahead and have them coach you through the vocal process. On the projects that I produce on my own, I always bring in a vocal coach.
That is a tip that I did not guess. Okay, so a vocal coach is an unsung hero. They can make you sound way better.
There you go, for sure.
Tell me an unsung hero that has made a difference in your career.
Well, my friend, of course there is you. See, before my wife and kids, I say you. But yeah, obviously my family, my wife and kids are very supportive. But I always think that the biggest unsung hero to me are the assistants that work on the projects that nobody knows. Those assistants, especially the ones working in Nashville, oh my God, a session could not run without them. They do everything. They set up all the gear. They go in the studio the night before. They wait for the studio to come clear. So whoever's recording that day, they might be done at 5, they might be done at 9. You don't know when they're going to finish. And that assistant stays there and waits because the second they're done, that assistant goes in and sets up for the next day. And they go in and set up for the next day. They get a list of microphones that the producer requests, and they'll go set up the room. They'll set up the positioning. They'll put the drum kits in where they need to be. Then they'll set up all the cabling. They'll run it through all the wall into the consoles, and they get the tape machine running. They make sure everything's running correctly. It takes all night long. And then when that morning comes, the producer and everybody shows up at that time. They're all fresh. You're beat. But now it's the time that they see you. Now you get to turn it on and be, you know, Johnny on the spot at that point and be ready to go. So, yeah, by far those are the unsung heroes. I can't stress it enough.
Yeah. Wives and assistants are the unsung heroes.
Yes, but don't confuse those to being the same thing because that doesn't go over well. Wife is not an assistant. A big thanks to Rena for joining us tonight and turning the tables on me to uncover some of my own stories. And as always, thank you for joining me here. I really do appreciate it. Please follow, share, connect on all the socials. I'd love to talk to you. You can do that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode40. And if you'd like to know more about Rena, check out episode number 35, where we talk about her career and her time on the Jerry Springer Show. You can also check out her show, Better Call Daddy, where Rena talks uncensored to some amazing guests. I really like episode number 213. However, there are hundreds to choose from. Well, thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.